When they asked me to do a class, we thought it'd be a good idea, as long as we're going to do conference next year, we thought it'd be a good idea to at least do some kind of a introduction to the subject for next year. So this is sort of like a springboard class to try to give you some idea like what we'll be looking at next year, God willing, if we're still around. And so my goal was to have a look at some of the exciting things that you can run into in classes on the Return of the Exiles. And the other thing I want to look at is I want to focus in on some of the areas that people find the most difficult to understand about the Ezra-Nehemiah period. So that's really the game plan for tonight. And I guess part of that goal is also to keep you awake. So we'll try to do that too. Now, why would you ever want to study the period about the Return of the Exiles? It really comes, it's the end of the Old Testament, really, and it's the springboard for what happens when Jesus Christ shows up on the scene and returns. What it will do, though, it's going to tie together the whole period of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and Haggai, the prophets Haggai, and Zechariah, and Malachi, and you even get some of Jeremiah and Daniel mixed in. So it's really, it's a big period in terms of Bible prophecy and some of the Bible events that are happening. And if you've never really studied that period all at once in one week or, you know, made a detailed study of it, some of those events are probably just hanging out there as like independent things, and you don't realize how interconnected they actually are. What it will also do is give you a really good understanding of the background to the Jewish community when Jesus Christ was born and came on the scene. And you start wondering, like, how did the Jews ever become a group of people who had, like, Pharisees and Sadducees, and they were all into, like, following the law like that, and the details and the rituals of the law? What in the world happened to this community? And they weren't like that before. They weren't like that in the Old Testament times like that, and they'd given up on idolatry entirely, and now they've gone into focusing on the law. And you'll see why when you look at the Ezra-Nehemiah period. It's really, it's an interesting period for those of you who like history. If you're one of those history people and you happen to like history, it's really politically, it's a great period to study when you look at the Medes and the Persian kings and what was happening in the empire at that time. And there's a lot of political intrigue that goes on. We'll look at some of that tonight. I'll give you a little foreshadowing of what's going on with some of the cool events that are happening. And you get to watch the work of the angels behind the scenes. Angels were just manipulating events all over at this period. They were controlling what was going on. They were setting the scene so that everything would happen as God had intended. And you find that out when you start looking at prophets like Zechariah, and he actually shows you what's going on behind the scenes as to how active the angels were to bring about all these things. And it deals with some of the typical problems that we face individually and as a community today, as young people in your COICs. You'll see some of these things that you deal with, and how did they deal with them back in those times? What did they do when they ran into these problems? And it's got great lessons for us as living as members of God's family, and it really is good for the young people. And, oh yeah, there's also that reason it's probably going to be your ticket to come to youth conference if you want to come again next year. You got to get the work done, right, in order to get here. So anyways, those are all great reasons, though, to have a look at it. When you some of the things when you study, when you look at the Ezra and Nehemiah period on the Return of the Exiles, you're going to find out that we read in our Bible of how, when you read the story of Ezra, and the beginning part of Ezra talks about Jeshua and Zerubbabel returning from Babylon, and they come down into the land. And then later on, you find Ezra returns to the land. And then later on, you read about Nehemiah coming down and returning to the land. And I don't know if you're like me, my assumption was they always came the same way. What you'll find out, though, when you look at this, is they didn't go the same way. Ezra and Nehemiah did, probably, but actually the original group went a different journey. So when you're reading about that, you'll find out that they left this area here, took the captives up the Euphrates River, and came way on down this way. It's about a 1,000-mile trek. That's a long way to come. This was a tough journey. And you'll start reading about how they did this in Joshua and Zerubbabel in the early chapters of Ezra. Then when you get to Ezra coming back, you're going to find out that Ezra went in, he talked to the king and said, you know, I want to go back, and now the temple's built, I want to work in the temple, and the king gave him all kinds of stuff and gave him permission to go back, and he just told the king how he was into worshiping his God and how God would take care of him, and Ezra looks at that and says, you know, I better not go this way, I'm going to go this way, and even though it's more dangerous, I'm not even going to take the king's the military support that he offered me. And so you'll start looking at how different people handled the same event, but they handled it in a different way. And you can sort of contrast what Ezra did versus what Joshua and Zerubbabel did, and have a look at how they traveled to Jerusalem. But when you get to that point, it's sort of interesting to note the differences. When you look at how this period fits together, if you've never studied the return after of the exiles, when they came back in that whole period there, really what happens is Joshua and Zerubbabel, they return first. They come back in the first wave. Cyrus makes a decree, lets them go back, and they come back, they set up the altar, they start working on the temple, and they basically get the temple done. So they begin working on the temple in the early chapters of Ezra. But then what happens over 20 years is the work on the temple, or about 15, 16 years, it sort of like drags on. You know, it's like those projects you have at home sometimes, or some of those school projects you get into, like writing a research paper, and you know how it just like goes on and on. And after a while, you lose interest in it. And the people did. They lost their interest in working on the temple. It had gone on for about 15, 16 years. And so they stopped working. And then that's where Zechariah and Haggai come into play. If you never realize how all this fits together, this is what you get to look at next year. Here are two prophets that God raises up in order to motivate the people to get back to work and finish this temple. And then Ezra, once the temple is finished, Ezra comes back, because he's an old man at this point, and he couldn't work on the temple. But as soon as it's done, he makes the trek, comes down, and he now begins to organize the temple services. And you'll find that in Ezra 7 to 10. So it really, if you've never looked at this period, it all hangs together pretty good. But what you may not realize is intermixed in this is like the story of Esther. And then you start realizing that what God was doing is that now that the people had come back, the first wave had come back with Joshua and Zerubbabel. And then a period of like 20 years goes by, and now Ezra brings back some more people. But Ezra, when he goes to collect people up in Babylon, he could hardly get anybody to come. And now the temple's finished, and he looks around when he gathered everybody together, and they're all standing there at the river, and he looks around, and he realizes he doesn't even have any priests. And here he is coming back to worship in the temple and set up temple worship, and none of the priests even wanted to come back. No more, at least, than had gone originally. And so what was happening is the interest in the Jews was waning. They didn't really want to come back. A lot of them had settled in up there in the north. They were situated, and they were fine. And so then you see how God could use the situation with Esther and how that whole situation with Haman came along. And Haman sets a date, and he's going to exterminate all the Jews, going to annihilate them all. And then you realize that what God was trying to do was nudge the Jews to realize that you better get back to the land. This is where you all belong. So you know, historically, it's fun to watch how angels were orchestrating events in this period in order to accomplish the goal of having God's people return home. And then Nehemiah comes along in the next few years and builds the walls of Jerusalem. And then Malachi is really near the end. Malachi, our last prophet, near the end of Nehemiah's life there. Malachi warns about what was happening in the community as they were turning into a bunch of religious legalists. And this is the tendency that they were going into at this time. And then you end up with the last chapter of Nehemiah, really, is the end of the Old Testament. So that's the background of this period and how it will all fit together. And if you never looked at it before, it'll be a fun time for you. And it's good to get those pieces of the Bible and see how they all fit together. And what it helps you do is remember then for the rest of your life, you start to remember how it's all integrated. It's really a fun period to look at. If you've never seen this chart right here, this is out of H.P. Mansfield's. That's the one that Brother Jim was just referring to when you're looking at his grave. H.P. wrote the story of the Bible, and he put this little integrated chart here about the Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther period. And if you've never seen that, you might want to keep a copy of that handy and have a look at it next year. It's right out of Story of the Bible, but it's a lot more detailed. You're going to be looking at some of the kings. You know, so you're going to pick up this period. Like right now, we are in Daniel 10, and Uncle Jim was looking at how the end of Daniel's life right there, you'd come into the first year of Cyrus. He had lived through all those kings up there, the kings of Babylon. So you're going to want to go back and review some of what things that happened at the captivity. How Nebuchadnezzar had been the king of Babylon that had taken the captives away at two different times. Then his son Evil-Merodach came in. He's referred to in the Bible a couple of times. And then the third king was Nergal-Sharezer right there, which really the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about. Maybe they're in Jeremiah 39. And then you've got Labashi-Marduk right here. And then what happens at the end is these two guys come along, Nabonidus and his son Belshazzar, which you probably recognize from Daniel's prophecies. And what was happening is that Nabonidus is actually the king. He didn't really want to sit in the capital city and reign. He liked to go out on excursions. And so he leaves his son over there as co-regent in the city. And this is when the Medes and Persians overcame and took over and set the basis for the whole decree to let the Jews return back to their land. So it's good to have, you know, some of that background there, and I threw in the chart there on the chronology of Daniel and his contemporaries. And what I'll do with the whole PowerPoint, I'll post it online for those of you that want it, and you can use it next year if you still remember that it's there. And you can go back and say, oh yeah, I remember Uncle Jim gave that class a year ago, didn't he? Or if you forget, maybe one of your friends will remind you. And you can pull the PowerPoint down, and hopefully some of these charts will help you piece together some of those things that happened. One of the other ones that's fun to look at is these were the Persian kings. So and when you look back into history, this is one of the things that historians try to understand and figure out. But we know Cyrus the Great. Cyrus is the one that made the decree and then let the Medes help out the first couple of years, as Brother Jim mentioned. But he makes the decree to go ahead and send the Jews back. So he returns them to the land. He only reigned for like another 8-9 years. His period of reigning, when you look at him in history, was about, I think it's like 18 years or so. But about half of that, 9 of those years had taken place reigning as a Persian king when the Babylonian Empire was still in power. So if you're complicated, you start looking at history as to why they say he reigned so long, it's because they're including years before they actually conquered Babylon. Then his son Cambyses right there comes along and he reigns next. And then that's it for that line. It's like it dead ends right there. And Cyrus, then his son, and his brother Bardenia right there didn't reign as well. This guy, we think, Cambyses, it seems as though there was a political coup and he was killed at some point. And then what happened is it went over to Darius over here, Darius the Great. And people in history wondered for years, like, what in the world went on? And you'll go back and look at it, you know, there's some arguments in history as to what actually happened, but what people have pieced together is what they think occurred is that this fellow came along who was a total imposter. This fellow they refer to as Gomedes, or he's sometimes called Pseudo-Smertus because he presented himself as Smertus. Some people think he actually pretended to be this guy here, Bardenia, and he probably was orchestrating the death of Cambyses. He tried to take over the kingdom, and he takes over the kingdom, but only for about 7 months, and people realize he was an imposter. But during that little period, that little 7 months when he took over, that was such a critical period because this is when all the pressure came on the Jews to stop the work. This is when this king panics and he sends down the armies and he makes them stop building the temple by force. He didn't want any rebellion. He didn't know how to even control the empire. He really wasn't even supposed to be the king. So it's interesting to look at how angels could orchestrate these events, put this fellow in power for just a little window of time, like a half a year, and then when the Jews finally responded and Zechariah and Haggai were ready to go, he removes him out of power, brings in Darius over here, or Darius, whatever you want to call him, and then Darius finishes the work. And then after Darius, if you read up in the Persian kings, you'll see there was Xerxes and then Artaxerxes Longimanus right here. And all these names are going to come up if you do any reading about this period. Now, I just want to pass on to you, though, when you look at it, you know, it's those of you that have spent time on this period, you'll realize that when you read Christadelphian writings, you're going to find out not everybody agrees on how all this fits into historical periods. Myself, I've been convinced what Brother Mansfield had and some of the others that have looked at this, that I really think you're looking at only these four kings right here for the whole period of the Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther situation. I really don't think you can expand it down to Xerxes right there into Esther or Artaxerxes Longimanus later on. What happens is you start adding about 50, 60 years on. Everybody's too old. You look at some of the genealogies that are listed and so on. It's just like Mordecai would be ancient. And some of these things that happen, they're just everybody's too old. So probably what you're going to be looking at next year are those four kings right there, from Cyrus down to Darius Hystaspes right here. And so it's not super complicated. It's really just these four guys right there, and you'll see they show up in the story of Ezra. But if you're reading other Christadelphian writings, just so you're aware, like some of the writings from England, they move into the period of Xerxes, and some of them even mention Artaxerxes Longimanus, and some of the history books will do this as well. There isn't total agreement on how this period fit together. When you look at what happened, I think it's fun to look at in terms of lessons today. If you just flip your Bibles over to the early chapters of Ezra, just look at what happened in terms of the building of the temple. This is in Ezra chapter 3. So the people had built an altar, then they had started to worship Yahweh back in the land. Now in chapter 3, they start working on the building of the temple. And what they did is they laid the foundation. So they cleared out all the junk from the previous temple that had been destroyed. And then they started to work on the temple in the second month, in verse 8 of Ezra 3. In the second year, they're coming to the house of God in Jerusalem. They rise up. He appoints the appointed Levites from 20 years old and upward to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. They start building, and so they cleared out the rubble. They start laying the foundation. It would be like putting the wall, the brickwork around the basis, or building the cement basis for this building right here. And once that happens, then you can start to visualize how big it's going to be and how good it's going to look, because you start seeing the supplies that we have, the kind of things that we have to work with. And what happens is, in Ezra chapter 3, if you look down at verse 12, you know, here they are, they're in verse 10, they're laying the foundation of the temple. The priests stood in their apparel, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, and they got their cymbals to praise the Lord according to the ordinance of David of Israel, the king of Israel. And they sang responsively, they're praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he's good, his mercy endures forever toward Israel. And all the people are shouting with a great shout. They were excited, except the old ones. The ones that had been little kids when Nebuchadnezzar had come in and sacked the city, destroyed the temple, knocked it over. And they remembered what the old temple looked like. They remembered all the gold that was in the temple. They remembered all the great things that they had back in those days. And you see what happens in verse 12. Many of the priests and the Levites that headed the fathers' houses, who were old men, who had seen the first temple, they wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many people shouted for joy. And what happens then at this point is that there's different backgrounds in the community. This is what real life is about. Collegial life, family life, this is what you happen in CYCs. Not everybody's coming to the group with the same background. And so they had to deal with the fact that some of the older people didn't like this temple. They didn't think this was very good. Some of them almost got to the point where they thought it wasn't even worth building. They looked at what the younger people were doing and they despised it. They just thought, this is no good. This is nothing like what we had before. And the younger people, you know, they're trying to get pumped up and get excited about doing the best that you can. And I think it's fun to look at that in terms of our lives today, because we may not be able to do some of the great things that people did before. Maybe in your ecclesial area, you only have a small group and you only have a few people. Your CYC might be really small. You can't do as many things as you hear about other groups doing. What God cares about, though, is that you're active in doing the best you can with what you have. And this is what you'll see in this whole period when they were working on the temple. So Haggai has to come along in chapter 2, and he has to really try to get to the older people and make them rethink this. And he looks at it, and he just hits them direct, and he says, look it, is it not in your sight as nothing? Like, you look at this temple that they're building, and you don't think it's worth it. And so over time, over that 15 years, the older folks, they sort of lost, they lost interest. They probably talked to younger people and they discouraged them in the work. And this is what was happening in the community. Zechariah chapter 4 comes along and he sees this vision of how excited the angels are to get this work done. And he sees these two trees with pipes coming out of the trees, going into the lampstand and the light burning. And he tries to get them to realize that you don't even need people for this. Like the temple, this light's coming directly, the oil's coming right into the lamp from the trees, and no people are even involved. Because not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord, this will get done. And he says, look it, you may not like this, but the angels rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of the workers. And they can't wait until this temple's finished. They were excited about the work. And some of the people were discouraged. They were discouraging other people. And so you start to see all the dynamics that are going on in the ecclesial life at that time. And it's fun to look at those and realize that we're no different today. You're going to see a lot of these same things. And so you come away with lessons like learning to appreciate what God has given you, what he allows you to do, and be thankful for what you have. Be content and do the best you can with what God has given you. And don't worry about the past. Don't worry about if it could have been better or it was better before. Just do the best you can with your circumstances and who you have to work with. And you'll see those kind of lessons coming out in this period. You'll also run into things like in Ezra chapter 4. And what I did tonight is I focused a little bit more on Ezra than Nehemiah, because I think most of you know less about Ezra than you do about Nehemiah. At least that was my personal background growing up in Sunday schools. We spent a lot more time on Nehemiah and building the walls and all that kind of stuff than we did on the Ezra period. And Ezra, to me, was always a bit hazy as to what is this all about. But in Ezra chapter 4, look what happens. They start working on the temple, and now the Samaritans get involved. The Samaritans weren't really Jews. They weren't people of real Jewish background. Remember how when the Assyrians had come in earlier and the northern kingdom had been carried away captive? And what the Assyrian kings did in order to control their empire is they took people out of the land, and then they brought other people from other areas they had conquered, and they brought them into Israel. And they started filling up northern Israel with all these non-Jews. And these were the Samaritans that Jesus refers to in his day. This is the background to where these Samaritans actually came from. And so these people, they came along and they wanted to get involved. Hey, you got the king's, you got the king on your side here. You're coming down with all this money and you got to build this temple. And it's like, ooh, this is something we want to jump into as well. And so they said, hey, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. Well, they didn't really worship Yahweh. Heck, anybody remember what happened when the Samaritans first came in? They didn't know anything about Yahweh. And so they actually teach the people a little bit, because things were happening in the land that they were so obnoxious to God in the land at that period. So look, they say, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. And we sacrifice to him since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. So now there's a challenge. What are we going to do? Are we going to compromise? You look around and you figure, oh, look at that. They would have some big, strong guys that were willing to help out in the work. You know, they probably could provide food for the workers. They could do all kinds of help. And the tendency would have been, yeah, they might even had a guy that went around and woke everybody up in the morning, screamed and yelled at them. Yeah, you could have just used all those resources. But the leaders, Joshua and Zerubbabel, they realize, wait a minute, we're building a house to Yahweh our God. We can't just compromise from the beginning. We're not going to take advantage of this. We want our people to build this. And so they used the excuse in this case. They said, look at the king, when he made the decree, he said to the Jews to build a house for Yahweh, the God of Israel, as this King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. But these Samaritans then, when they found out they couldn't help, they caused all kinds of trouble. Then they started, hiring people to work against them. They started to infiltrate the ranks. They wanted to, get in there and stop the work. You won't let us help? Then we're going to stop you. You can see how much they really cared about it. Well, the great test at this point, when you look back at the 70-year captivity, and you look at why were the Jews taken out of the land? What had happened in Israel's history? Go back to the times of the judges. You go through the period of the kings. And you go through all these different periods of Israel's past history, and you look at what was the common problem all along, and the problem was always idolatry. They never really had gotten the Canaanites out of the land, and the idols of the Canaanites had come into the community. So what God did is he said, look, because you've chosen that, I'm going to kick you out of the land for 70 years until you learn not to worship idols and you realize that Yahweh is in control, and I'm going to clear out the land, and then I will grow a remnant. I'll let a remnant come back and we'll start over. So now is the test. Are they going to return to idols? That had been the primary cause of their problem. Were they willing to separate from the nations and stand fast for Yahweh, their God, and guard the truth? Were they going to resist the temptation to have the Samaritans come in? And as soon as they came in, they would bring their idols with them and would lead the people astray. And what happens at this point is, yeah, they did. They passed the first test. They resisted the temptation to go back to idolatry. In fact, you'll notice that the Jews at this point don't go back to idolatry anymore. When Jesus shows up on the scene, the problem isn't idolatry. The problem is legalism. It's all the legalistic people that they had and what they had done with the law and the mistreatment of God's law. It really wasn't the problem of idolatry. So yes, the 70-year captivity had accomplished its goal. God had kicked idolatry out of these people. But the next test was endurance. Are they going to be able to endure? Are they going to remain faithful through trials to their God? Were they really ready to endure tribulation from without, from the pressures of the Samaritans coming in, problems that were going to develop. You'll see in the Nehemiah period how Nehemiah refers to that there were pressures from without and there was trouble from within the community. He was getting pressured from the Jews from within his own community. Were they ready to endure this at this period of time? And were they willing to do this and maintain some kind of steadfastness to their God at this point in faith? And the problem was, no, they weren't. And you'll see how they fail in this time and time again in the Ezra-Nehemiah period. And I think the warning to us today, young people, is this is our problem. But we're not really into idolatry, but endurance? Endurance is the problem. You know, troubles come into your life. Things happen. You're on your way home. Somebody has an accident. You get back home. You don't have a job. You're having trouble at school. There's family problems, ecclesial troubles, and all these different things, health issues. Our problem is, are we going to remain faithful to the end? And these people struggled with this, as you will see in the Ezra-Nehemiah period. Now, as long as you're in Ezra 4, that would be worth looking at. One of the most complicated things in the Ezra-Nehemiah study, in fact, if you can understand all this tonight, the rest of the study will be a breeze next year, because this is all the tough stuff, and try to give you some help going through this. But you know, when you look at Ezra 4, when the Samaritans tried to discourage the people, look at what it tells you here. They troubled them in verse 4 in the building, and they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. All the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, so he's the fellow that made the decree, even until the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. Now see, that's giving you a span of years. It's, you know, they started with Cyrus, and they kept going all the way to Darius. What then happens in verse 6 is he then backtracks in years and tells you some of the specifics that went on during that period. In the reign of Ahasuerus, at the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. But the people kept building, because Ahasuerus didn't stop the work. But then in the days of Artaxerxes, in verse 7 there, Bisham and Meredith and Tebel and the rest of the companions, they wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the letter was written in the Aramaic script and translated into the Aramaic language, and they wrote and they said all these things about all these people. If they finish this thing, they're going to rebel against you. They're building up Jerusalem. They're trying to, like, you know, they're going to do a conspiracy. They're going to rebel. And this Artaxerxes right there in verse 7, this was the imposter. This was the fellow that came in, and he's scared stiff because he realizes he shouldn't even be the king. And as soon as he gets this letter saying that, wow, these people are going to rebel, he just sends the army down and says, stop the work. Stop. And God made the work stop at that period. And when you go back and you look at that, this is the key to understanding the kings in this whole period right here. So the temple work is actually stopped in the reign of Artaxerxes there in verse 7. That's where he comes along in verse 7. And you can read the whole letter if you want to, what they said. But the whole issue is in verse 23, when the letter's over, he responds back and he says that when the letter was read to him, that they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews and by force of arms made them cease. And thus the work on the house of God at Jerusalem ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia, Darius there. So that's what happened. Now we know that the temple actually was finished. In chapter 6, you can actually figure out when they actually got it done. It was finished in Darius's sixth year. So it stopped until the second year of Darius. It was finished in the sixth year. So you go back and you look in the history of this period, and you see, all right, here's what really happened then. They started working in Cyrus's year here, probably around Cyrus's 11th year or so. They started working on the temple. It continued in the reign of his son, Cambyses, for another 8 years or so. Then this fake guy comes in, and he only lasts for 7 months, but during that period, he sends out the decree, and he says, stop the work. And it stopped until the second year of Darius right here, and it started up again right there, and then it was finished in the sixth year of Darius. So it gives you a little bit of a perspective of what the time period is that we're dealing with right here. And that's the key to understanding these kings in Ezra chapter 4. The four kings that come up are Cyrus, and we know that they bothered him from the days of Cyrus all the way to the days of Darius. And then the other two guys that came in here in our Bible in Ezra 4, they're called Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes. But those aren't specific names. Those are just titles. It would be like saying president, it would be like saying prime minister or whatever you have in your country. And because different people had different names for the titles, you'll see them referred to differently. They don't actually give them their specific names. This fellow we know in history was Cambyses II, that was the son of Cyrus the Great. And then this other fellow is the one they refer to as Gomedes, or the pseudo-Smyrtus guy that came along. And then after him, the people, they put Darius Hystaspes back in power, and Darius then reigned, and he's the one where the temple finished. So that chart may help some of you when you're looking at this period to make some sense of what actually went on. And here's a little more detailed time period as to what happened during these 20 years. So the temple starts back in here in Cyrus's reign. It started around 536. Cyrus was killed then, and his son took over Cambyses. It continued working. Finally, the temple stopped during this period of Gomedes right there in 521. And then what happened is they started working again around 522 there. And they started working again in 520. And finally, they got the temple finished here in 516. And then, as soon as the temple's finished, then once it's done, Ezra comes back right away, because it makes sense. Once the temple's finished, his goal was to come back and work in the temple. And then later on, Nehemiah comes along and realizes that, yeah, although the temple got built, nothing else in Jerusalem is getting done. It's like they stopped at that period, and all the walls are still broken down, and so he comes back and tries to then work on the walls. You know, if you were going to go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem at this time, if you were going back, what would you build first? The walls or the temple? Well, would you build the walls around the city, or would you build the temple first? What would you do first? The walls, right? And you'll start seeing that this is one of the things that went on in the great arguments in ecclesial life, is don't finish the temple. We should build the walls. We need defenses. We gotta have defenses against these Samaritans, against all these people they're bringing in, against the Persians. And this is a great argument that went on at this period. And it took faith to believe, as Zechariah and Haggai are going to try to tell the people, don't worry about the walls. God will be walls of fire around you if you get back to work on his temple. But this is what God does to people. He wants to see faith in action. He wants to see that you really believe and that you'll trust him to take care of you. And so this happened in this period. When you go back and you look at, well, why did the work stop? Why would God allow, and in fact, not only allow, he actually orchestrated with his angels to stop the work. After 16 years they've been working on this temple, 15, 16 years, he finally brings about a situation where a pseudo-imposter comes in as king, he sends the army down, and he stops the work. Why would you do that? Well, when you go back and look at the prophets, you find out, well, the people had become discouraged. Some of them were arguing their case of, this is no good, why even bother finishing? It's nothing like what we had before. They didn't like this new temple. Some of the adversaries had hired counselors against them to frustrate their work. Some of the workers, you find out in Haggai's prophecy, they got tired of building God's house. They wanted to go home and work on their own. And they didn't just want to have a house. They don't have a shack like some of you see the cabins around here. They wanted to have paneled houses. They wanted to have nice places to live in. And then there were the people that were afraid of the adversaries. And for all those reasons, they stopped the work. And I think there's a great lesson in this whole period to the young people especially, that we sit around sometimes and we think, well, if I had this, then I would be really interested. If I had this. And we start bringing up all the excuses about why we can't be involved in God's work, why we're not involved more in our CYCs and in our ecclesias. And in the end, what God does is he says, look, if you don't really want to work, I'll make it so you can't work. And he lets us have what we want. And unfortunately, sometimes that's what it takes once in a while for us to realize. We get hit with an illness. We get struck with a situation where we lose a job or something goes wrong at our schooling. And all of a sudden in your family, something's happened. And now you can't do what you had thought you wanted, God's work anymore. And he pulls it away until we learn to appreciate it. And you'll see him doing this case with the period of Ezra at this time. So if the work on the temple, if it began in the second year, how long did it take, or how long did the work actually stop? That's one of the key things that comes up in this period. I hear a lot of Christadelphians giving classes once in a while in this period, and they refer to it, and they make it sound like, oh, the work stopped for a long time. But really, if you think about it, how long did the work stop? So when the king comes in and says, you can't work anymore, and he sends the army down, and he stops the work. He stops it. All right, then he only lasts 7 months, so it probably would have taken a while for him to even do that. So he only lasts as king for 7 months, and then Darius comes along, and Darius comes in, and when did they start working again in the reign of Darius? What year? see how you've been listening tonight. Mm-hmm. What year was it when they started up again? The second year. So really, there's at most a two-year window in there in which they quit. In fact, what happens in the reign of Darius in the second year is that the adversaries write again and they try to convince him to stop the Jews because he says, look, they're back to working again. And in the second year, you find out he responds. So somewhere in there, it could have been a period of a year and a half or so, something like that. That's really about how long God let them sit on it for a while and then got them going again with Zechariah and Haggai's prophecies and got them back to work. But it wasn't some long 10, 15, 20-year period where they quit working entirely. It really was only about a two-year window in there. So maybe about 2 years. Now, the building of the temple, when you look at how long it took, you add up all the years. The rest of Cyrus's reign, when they were working on the temple, is about 6 years. His son Cambyses, he comes in about 8 years. The fake guy is about 7 months, and then in the sixth year of Darius, or Darius there, they finished the temple. So you're looking at a time period of about 20 years to get this temple done. And you might think, well, why does that really matter? Well, actually, that comes into play in this whole period here about the 70-year captivity. Remember that. It took about 20 years. Jeremiah had prophesied that because of the faithlessness of the Jews, God was going to kick them out of the land. Now, when he first said that was in the reign of Daniel, or in Daniel's days, back in the reign of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was this king back in here, Jehoiakim. Jeremiah gave a prophecy back in those days, and he said, look, it was in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. He said, it's going to be 70 years. God's going to punish Babylon in the end, and God's going to, at this point, he's going to remove the Babylonian captivity. Because the people had just been taken captive. This was way back here at this point. This is when Daniel went captive. He went in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and he goes off to Babylon. So that's fourth year of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim reigned 11 years. And then his son Jehoiachin reigned for 3 months. And then Zedekiah reigns for another 11 years. So it's another 20 years before, really, when the period of the captivity, when Zedekiah was finally taken. So you've got about a 20-year period in there. So what happens is that you can start the 70-year captivity in the fourth year of Jehoiakim right here and have it end then when the temple was started, when the decree of Cyrus went out to start working on the temple. Jeremiah 29 actually said, and this was in the early years of Zedekiah, that after 50 years, this is early in this period here, in Zedekiah's day, he said, look, God's going to bring the Jews back and give them a future with peace and hope. And it refers to a 70-year period. It's actually possible that they may not be referring to exactly the same 70 years. And when you watch what actually happened, here's what went on. The people realized this. They said, look, 70 years. God said it was going to be 70 years. And so what they did is they said, look, if we start the 7 years right here in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and we're working on the temple over here, in that case you'd say, all right, then maybe it should be done. But what they did is they said, look, we didn't really go captive, some of the captives here, we didn't go until Zedekiah's last year, when finally the temple was destroyed. And if God said 70 years, and you go 70 years from here, it's way out in here somewhere, and the time's not even right to build this temple. And this was the argument that was going on. Is this really the right period? So they were arguing the case that the 70 years wasn't really over. And that's why you get into this argument. Is it the 70 years from Jehoiakim right here, all the way through until when they started building, or do you start the 70 years right here? And if you start it at that period, it doesn't end until much later on, which is actually when the temple was finally finished, in that period right there. So it's fun to look at that, and you try to look at what was going on in this period and appreciate what the people were debating and arguing. So they argued their case, and they said it's not the right time. So Haggai 1 says what the people did instead is they paneled their homes. They went out and they worked overtime on their jobs. They tried to fill their pockets with all kinds of money. They tried to have their retirements all set up, and they were like filling their bank accounts. And they had these big bank accounts and everything, and they put the money in their pockets. And Haggai says, don't you realize what God did? He put holes in your pockets, and the money went right on through. You thought you had all these great crops coming in. You thought it was all good, and God just blew it all away. And he ruined their economic times because they weren't working on his house. And that's what you'll see when you start looking at Haggai. So a few months into this then, after the work on the temple stopped, and Zechariah and Haggai are stirring up the people to work, then God raises up Darius to be the king. And once Darius comes in, he's an established Persian king. He's got the history for it, for supporting himself. What he does is he spends the first 2 years bringing down the revolts that had happened in the empire while Gomedes was around. Because as soon as some of the outskirts of the empire found out this guy in power doesn't really have any control, what they started doing was rebelling. And so the angels went to work. They thought they had it all done before. Well, now they have to bring all the world back under control. And Zechariah 1 tells you about the angels coming back and giving a report. And they said, look it, we brought the world back under control of the Persians. Can't we get this temple finished? The angels talking to God, you know, trying to figure out, like, when is this going to finish? Because they were excited to get this job done. So what happened then is that God helped them out. He threw at them two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. And Haggai comes in and he exhorts the people and he says, look, you made bad choices. You gave up on the work of God's house. You had lack of faith. You went after your own things. And look at what you've got for it. Nothing. Because God ran inflation through your country and really nothing. All this stuff you accumulated isn't worth a whole lot. But what, if you've never studied Zechariah before, what you'll find what Zechariah does, both prophets working at the same time, one of them goes after the people and really goes after the people and exhorts them about what they were doing. That's not what Zechariah does. Zechariah shows the people a little window behind the scenes of what's going on in God's family in heaven. And he says, look at what angels have been doing for you. Look at how involved the angels are in the work that's going on right now. Look at how they've orchestrated the political events. Look at how they've done all these things, and the angels are ready to go. They are excited to get this temple done, and God has told them it will get done in the days of Jeshua, the high priest, and the days of Zerubbabel, who really would have been in line of the king. You had your king priest right there. He promises to get the work done now. And it worked. The people went back to work. And in 4 years, they had the temple done. So you're going to be looking at Zechariah's, what we refer to as the seven night visions. And if you don't remember, in the first six chapters of Zechariah, Zechariah sees a vision in chapter one. He sees these horsemen coming in. And these horsemen ride in, and they stop under the tree. And Zechariah's talking to an angel. And he says to the angel, what are these guys? And the angels are talking to the other angel, and they're coming in, and they said, look it, we've been out patrolling the whole earth, and we brought the earth back to rest. Because they did. After the revolts that had gone on with Gomedes, when Darius came back in as king, they had to bring the empire back under control. So then, at the end of chapter 1, there's another vision about the carpenters. And he sees this vision about how carpenters. Now, who would the carpenters be? Well, these were the fellows that were working on the temple. And what the carpenters did is they went after these strong horns and they totally destroyed these four horns that had previously oppressed the people. You start looking at how God was trying to show them that, look at, no trouble. The angels are going to help you to overcome. He'll use you, the carpenters, and you're going to overcome those powerful horns and the powers that had been that had suppressed the work at the time. And then he shows him a third vision. He says, look, in chapter 2, Zechariah sees a vision. He sees a guy going out, and what he does, he takes a tape measure. And he wants to measure Jerusalem, the walls. And he's thinking about, we're going to build the walls. Let's build the walls of Jerusalem. And an angel says to the other angel, and he says, look, go out and run after that guy and tell him, forget it. We don't need any walls. God will be a wall of fire around you. You finish the temple, and it will be okay. Forget about the walls for right now. And then he sees this vision in chapter 3, he sees another vision right in here where he sees people standing before God, and there's like the Samaritans are there, and they're represented as Satan. And then there's Joshua, who's their high priest, Joshua. And the Samaritans are there, and they're trying to convince that, you know, they're trying to build their case for the fact that you shouldn't finish this temple. And he sees the angel stands up, and he says, look at, the Lord rebuke you. And he rebukes the Samaritan and says, you're not going to stop this anymore. This work is going to get finished. And in chapter 3, the promise is made it will be finished in the days of Joshua the high priest. We're not going to wait for another high priest to come along. It says it will be done in his day. Joshua, your robes are all dirty. You're dirty from building the walls. It's okay. We're going to take off your robes. We're going to put clean robes on you, and you will serve as high priest in this temple. And so that was a promise that God made. All you had to do is believe him and get the work done. And then in chapter 4, that's when he saw the one about the lampstand coming in from the trees. No people involved. The oil just ran directly into the lampstand. And God promises he will get the work done. And that's what he says. It won't get done later on. He promises the man whose name is the branch, that Zerubbabel, you will be there when this work is finished. And then there's the exhortational chapter. You get to chapter 5 in Zechariah, and God says, once my house is finished, I'm going to clean up the land. Either you participate in this the way it should be, and you worship Yahweh the way he wants to be worshipped in his house, or you're out of here. You're kicked out. You go back up to Babylon. And he sees a vision of how this woman, who's like, you know, this, who represents all the wickedness of the people, and she's carried off to Babylon. And then all those priests who wouldn't come back down, they set up a whole religious system in Babylon that the Jews had that was an apostasy at that time. And that's what you'll see when you get there. And then there's the vision in chapter 6 of how the angels are going out again, controlling the earth. They're out there and riding on their horses, and they promise that there's nothing that will stand in the way of getting this temple finished. Now, Zechariah saw all that one night, and then he went back and he told the people, here's what I saw last night. And the people heard it, and they got motivated when they realized how dedicated God was to getting this temple finished in the days of Zerubbabel and Joshua. If you get a chance to look at how they all fit together, it's fun to look at how Haggai and Zechariah do fit together, if you get a chance to do that next year, because they are integrated. They're both giving prophecies really at the same time. Haggai starts out, it's all in the second year of Darius right here, and he starts out and gives the first part of his prophecies. Then Zechariah comes along, still in the second year of Darius right there. He's in the eighth month now. And then Haggai prophesies in the ninth month. Zechariah comes back in the 11th month, and he sees the seven night visions that he saw. That is an interesting one if you get a chance to have a look at Zechariah 7 after the night visions, because what happened, this is now the fourth year of Darius. Fourth year. When was the temple finished? Which year? Not the fourth, the sixth. Sixth year. They started working on it, and again the second. You know, now we're in the fourth year, and it's finished in the sixth year. So we only got two more years to go. So what do you think? Do you think a lot of it was up at this point? I think a lot of the building was actually standing. There's only two more years to go, right? Probably a lot of the work was done. The people come, and they come up to Joshua, the high priest, and they say, you know, we've been mourning for the last 70 years over the destruction of Jerusalem. And we've been keeping these mourning periods four times a year to commemorate, you know, when the temple got destroyed, you know, when Nebuchadnezzar first came in. And they had these four periods during the year that they were commemorating. And they said, look, it looks like it's so much done right now. Do you think we should bother doing that anymore? You know, go through these periods where we were mourning and we were keeping these periods to Yahweh our God, you know, commemorating all this stuff. And God answers them and he says, are you kidding me? You really think you were mourning and you were like doing something for me these 70 years? And that's the way he looks at them. They turned into a bunch of ritualistic, going through the motions, people that had no heart in it. They're just going through the motions. And it'd be like going to meeting on Sunday and taking the bread and the wine, and you go away and you're not a changed person at all. This is what had happened to the Jewish community. And God looks at him and he says, was it for me? Was it for me that you did that? No way. You were doing it for yourselves. And all this time, 68 years had been going on. They've been keeping all this stuff 68 years. And he finally points out to him, he says, this wasn't for me. You didn't really care about me at this time. You were doing it for yourselves. You felt better by doing all that stuff. And it's an interesting prophecy in Zechariah 7, but it shows you about the hearts of the people at this time. So the temple finally got finished. When it was finished right here in the sixth year of Darius, then Ezra comes back probably in the seventh year. That would be my assumption, at least, at that period. Now, it's true that in the book of Ezra, it refers to the king at that period as a different name. It refers to him differently. But that's probably because up in Babylon, where Ezra was, they called him by a different name than the people did down in the land. They just had a different title for him at that time. But it was probably that sixth year. Then what happens is Nehemiah comes in, and Nehemiah builds a wall. And when you start looking at the Nehemiah period, I think probably a lot of you are much more familiar with that. But there's great lessons in this Nehemiah period. The people get together. Nehemiah motivates the people. He gets them working. And you know, it shows you what you can accomplish with a group of people in a very short period of time. In 52 days, they got this done. And they built the walls around the city in 52 days. They just worked 20 years on the temple. But Nehemiah stirred up the people. He got them organized. He gave them jobs to do, gave them sections of the wall. They had to clear out the rubble. They had to build the new stuff. And people got working. And what you're going to see when you look at Nehemiah, if you haven't done that before, is some people were just like so gung-ho, they couldn't wait to get to work. And they jumped in and they got their job done. And they finished their section of the wall. And then they started helping the guys next to them. And they kept going. And other people just sort of sat back and they didn't really care a whole lot. And then there were other people that while the work's going on of building the temple or building the walls, they're like behind the scenes, they're trying to make life better for themselves. They're making deals with like the Samaritan people, with the Geshem, the Arab. And they're making deals behind the scenes of stuff that they shouldn't even be dealing in. And all this is happening in the community at this time. And this is what Israel was really like. And you get to see how Nehemiah handled some of those problems at that period. It really is. It's a great time to look at the power of working together in CYCs and ecclesial life, and the idea of not compromising with the ungodly. Nehemiah refused, like Joshua and Zerubbabel had earlier, to compromise with those people that had tried to get involved. So I hope that's a good springboard for, I know you're getting tired tonight, so hopefully for next year, if those of you that want to show up and have a look at the Ezra and Nehemiah period and all the prophets that are there as well, I hope you enjoy your studies for the rest of this week here. I'm sure you will, and also in next year. If you're interested in this class and the PowerPoint that comes with it, you're welcome to pull that off of LavoniaTapes.com. When I get home tonight, I'll upload it tomorrow, and when you guys get home, you'll see it sitting there. But Andrew's got that website set up, LavoniaTapes.com, and I'll just put it in there as like the Return of the Exiles for California Youth Conference 2013 or something. And the PowerPoint will be there, which is probably more useful than everything I said tonight, because the PowerPoint's got some of the charts that we found or developed that help fit together the pieces of how all this period works. And hopefully that will help some of you, at least in your studies. So enjoy the rest of your studies this week. Yeah, if you have never used LavoniaTapes.com, that's probably a good one to have a look at. Anyways, thanks. Hope that helps out, and have a great rest of the week.